Appellant, the City of Westland Police and Fire Retirement System. Before I begin, I wanted to introduce at my council table Christian Keeney of my office. I don't know if Mr. Reed wanted to introduce himself as well as the people at his council table.
Good afternoon, John Reed for the Appellee Excels Technologies. I'll be presenting the argument, but I'd like to introduce with me at council table, both from my firm, are Paul Brown and Lynn Porterfield. Welcome.
Thank you, Your Honors. I've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. This case is about majority voting, the importance of the shareholder franchise, and the ability of the Delaware judiciary, frankly, to remain relevant on an important and developing issue of corporate governance. For at least the last 7 years, majority voting has gained increasing prominence to shareholders and the investing community, particularly as shareholders have demanded more accountability at the corporate boards. Under the plurality standard, the director elections were viewed mainly as a formality and a rubber stamp, particularly in the context of an uncontested election. Shareholder dissatisfaction with that has caused many companies to move to a majority
Barry,
standard.
Mr. Barry, yes. Spare us the speech.
Sure.
And let's get to the issue.
Sure. The voting scheme at issue here, which we've referred to as a kind of Pfizer-style policy, was adopted by companies as an alternative to going pure majority vote. Although over half of the S&P 500 have adopted majority voting, about 20% have adopted a scheme similar to that which Excellus has here. This Pfizer scheme, which was invented by Pfizer in about 2005, retains the plurality voting, but in the event that the director who's up for election fails to receive the affirmative vote of a majority of the votes cast, that director is required to submit his resignation.
But the board of directors is not required to accept it.
No, the board of directors then has the opportunity to determine whether or not to accept it.
Okay, there are some variations of the Pfizer type scheme where if directors who are up for election do not obtain a majority vote, then they're mandated to submit their resignation and the board is mandated to accept it. So the policy, my question is that it was possible in this company for the policy to be drafted a different way.
Oh, it's entirely possible for it to be drafted a different way. It's also entirely possible that it could have been adopted by a bylaw or even a certificate amendment. There are various variations on the theme of the Pfizer-style policy.
Okay, in this case, the board did not accept the resignation.
Exactly.
And my question is, does the mere fact that they decided not to accept the resignations give rise to an inference of wrongdoing?
It gives rise to an yes. I believe it ought to. And here's why. First off, shareholders very rarely withhold their votes. In 2009, out of over 12,000 elections, only 91 directors didn't get a majority vote. That's less than that's a quarter of 1%. In 2008, it was 32 out of 12,000. This is a very rare happening. The second thing is, as a result, what you have to look at, this does not involve an issue that involves the day-to-day operations of the company. We're not talking about how many widgets you're going to sell or the strategic plan for the company going forward. This issue involves a central matter of the shareholder franchise, which is who is going to serve on the board of directors. Who is going to serve as the elected representative of the shareholder?
Just to make sure I have your position right, your contention is that the Court of Chancery reversibly erred by not overturning the decision of the board?
No, that's absolutely not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that
by not finding an inference of wrongdoing sufficient to warrant an inspection of the books and records.
Yes, because this is such a unique situation, and because this situation arises in the context of corporate of who will serve as the elected representative of the shareholders, an issue that certainly is within the realm of the shareholder franchise, that yes, the shareholders ought to have an ought to have at the very least the opportunity to ask why, to demand an answer as to why. This isn't the kind of normal business decision that comes up every day at the board of directors. A, it's incredibly rare. It's only happened three times since 2005. Once, the first time was Excellus, the second time was Pulte Homes, and the third one happened last month at a company called Hurley. So it's happened three times, very rare. And not only that, because it's rare and because unique and because it relates to a central issue of who's going to serve on the board, it ought to allow the shareholders the opportunity to ask why. It ought to be a decision that has judicial.
And tell me what it is that's rare, that the people didn't get the requisite vote or that the board decided to retain them anyway. What happened three times?
The Pfizer policy has been triggered three times, meaning that at a company with a Pfizer-style policy in whatever form, only three times have directors not received the requisite majority vote. And that was it.
And so in our case, the board decided to keep the directors anyway.
Yes.
Is there a public record or public citation to what happened in the other two cases?
Yes. The other two cases was Pulte, and Pulte declined to accept the resignations as well. That was referenced in the briefs. And the Hurley happened last month. That's a matter. It's a matter of public record in the SEC filings. I can certainly provide information to the court. I have an article with me today that I ran across last night. But the point is those are the only three times it's ever happened.
Happened in Hurley? Did they keep them or not?
No, and Hurley, no. The Hurley was the first time the director they submitted the resignation, and the director did not, and the director is no longer on the board.
Okay.
So if we have a per se rule, why won't that frustrate the intent of the stockholders in enacting the bylaw that there be discretion? Because every time you act to refuse a resignation, you're going to get sued.
No, absolutely not. You're not going to get sued. And that's what I'm not talking about getting sued. Talking about getting right to per se liability.
Do me a favor. I'm from the South, and I just cannot follow anybody talking as fast as you talk. Certainly. Can you slow down just a little bit?
Certainly.
Thank you.
I'm not talking about directors being sued, and we're not talking about any sort of per se liability. What I am suggesting is that there ought to be an opportunity to ask the question. An opportunity to demand answers, an opportunity to investigate, an opportunity to serve a 220 request and say, show me why. Show me the documents to the extent that you have them that support your rationale and support the reasons that I can look at to say why you made that decision. I'm not talking about per se liability. I'm not talking about a per se ability to state a claim. But at the very least, the shareholders ought to have the opportunity to investigate, to ask the question.
Well,
by saying,
Mr. Barry,
sure.
Why should your legal position, that is what you're asking us to declare, I gather as a matter of first impression, as a matter of common law, not legislative in character? I mean, I can envision, for example, statute or an SEC rule, if this fell within the purview of the SEC's jurisdiction, saying that if you have a policy of this sort and the board decides not to accept the resignation, the mandatory offered resignation, then there's a duty to explain. That's essentially what you're driving at here, isn't it? That is, in circumstances like this, you want the rule to make the directors accountable to the shareholders for not accepting the resignation, and the accountability mechanism is 220.
At the very least, it ought to be 220, and let me explain why. This isn't legislating. This isn't legislating, although it can be done by legislation. There is existence. The Delaware precedent is clear that the kinds of decisions we're talking about today, the kinds of decisions that impact who's going to serve on the board, is not a matter that necessarily is entitled to the kind of deference provided routine day-to-day decisions under the business judgment rule. Established Delaware precedent says that where the directors are making a decision that impacts who is serving, that is that impacts the shareholder franchise, that rejects the intended vote of the shareholders, that the business judgment rule does not necessarily apply. Now, my colleague is going to stand up and say, it didn't, Your Honors, this vote didn't frustrate the intended outcome of the shareholder vote because they intended that they be elected under the plurality standard. But that ignores the purpose of the Pfizer-style policy. Well,
Mr. Berry, in this case, we have a limited explanation of why the board refused the resignations.
Yes.
What is it that you would, in the best case scenario for you, what types of things are, I saw your demand, but what types of things are you going to find if your 220 demand is granted?
I'd like to see the board minutes. I'd like to see whatever, if they've considered other alternatives. I'd like to see any, if they had any specific reasons for these particular directors. For example, one of the reasons that that pure majority voting could cause a problem is, for example, if some of the directors who didn't get elected and resign have special seats and have special skills that are required to be on the board in order to maintain listing requirements. And that if for example, that director resigns and there's no available candidate at the time, that could cause a problem for the board. So that's, for example, a reason that would certainly be justifiable that I'd like to find out. That's not what they've said here.
Just to pick up on Justice Hollings' question, is there any document, book, or record that would get at that issue other than the board minutes?
It may be anything that was prepared, that was considered with the board minutes or the board books or any for example, had they hired a consultant to go out and look for alternative candidates and say there are none or something to that end. I don't know what those documents may be. I know they may very well be in the minutes, but they may very well be elsewhere. All I'm asking is the opportunity to ask why.
Now, under 220, if you want to communicate with other shareholders, you can ask for that if your communication's for a legitimate purpose. You don't have to suggest wrongdoing. Is there a theory that would get you what you want in this case that's unrelated to wrongdoing? Or, if there's not, whether it's done as a matter of common law or statutory law, as I understand it, you're advocating a rule that in these unique circumstances, you ought to be able to get some follow-up.
Yes.
Without necessarily showing wrongdoing.
Well, I think that the issues that are present themselves in a decision by a corporate board to reject a director resignation itself raises the right to ask the question, the right to have the board explain itself, whether it be through the compelling justification standard in Blasius or a reasonableness type standard, i.e. Unocal. But at the very least, the existence of the issues presented give rise to an ability of the shareholders to require an answer.
Well, the reason I ask the question is, you know, when you come back to Blasius and M&M and Liquid Audio, all of those talk about the primary purpose. If we just look at the record in this case where we have an explanation, admittedly limited, the explanation seems to suggest that was not the primary purpose. So that standard may not get you where you want to be. And that's why my question to you is, if you can get some books and records under 220 for a legitimate purpose without showing wrongdoing, others you have to have, you know, this credible evidence standard that we talked about in Verizon, focusing on possible, maybe, wrongdoing. Do you fit within either one of those existing standards, or do you need a new type of standard?
Well, first of all, I think we fit within the existing standard. I do think that under the facts that we have here, and I'll go through the facts specifically, there is sufficient record evidence to suggest a credible basis to suspect that wrongdoing may have occurred. So I believe that we do have that record evidence, and I'll talk about that. But to the extent that the court disagrees, I do think that this is an opportunity for the court to say that if Blasius doesn't apply, something like it ought to allow for the shareholders to, at the very least, ask. Because here's what happens. Because if the shareholders, under the district court's, the Court of Chancery's analysis, do not have the ability to at the very least ask the question and seek judicial redress in the Delaware courts, if they can't even ask that question, then the usefulness of the Pfizer-style policy is eliminated altogether, because then I might as well just keep plurality voting or go to the pure majority voting, or I'm going to have to look elsewhere. And your suggestion as to the legislative fix, Your Honor, is exactly what's happening. Right now, in the Restoring American Financial Stability Act of 2010 that was introduced by Senator Dodd, he includes a provision that is exactly what this is. That is exactly that mandates a mandatory resignation followed by a detailed explanation if the directors don't accept that resignation. That's going on in Washington right now. Last week, Senator Carper introduced an amendment. By the way, I have the statute with me, and I have excerpts if the court would like to see it. Last week, Senator Carper introduced an amendment to the bill on the floor of the Senate to remove that. But that is that debate as to the federalization of that issue is going on right now, and it's created because of a vacuum here in Delaware because the shareholders can't ask the questions.
So there may be more to the point that this is a proper matter for legislation than appears at first blush.
It is a matter of legislation, but it's a matter that I don't think has to be addressed by legislation because the existing Delaware jurisprudence is completely able to address this and ought to, because the existing Delaware jurisprudence says that where the directors make a decision that is directly impacting who is sitting on the board and directly impacts that relates to the election of directors, then it is not a routine business decision and does not necessarily merit the kind of deference afforded every other kind of decision in this case.
Going back to your initial point about our relevance, does it really make any difference what we decide? The act to which you refer also includes proxy access and majority voting. We've already authorized that under Delaware law, and Congress is completely ignoring that because they're off on a frolic of their own, responding to the populist fervor of the day. So what do we accomplish if we were to adopt your rule? Congress is going to go away. They're going to say, oh, look what Delaware did. Let's be respectful to federalism and honor what Delaware has done. The answer is they're not going to do it anyway. So what's the point?
Well, to his credit, precisely what Senator Carper is arguing right now. But Delaware can't throw up its hands and say, I'm going to let Congress legislate whatever it wants in terms of disclosure because it's going to do whatever it wants anyway. And the reason is because regardless of what Congress does, there's a fiduciary obligation of the directors to act in the best interest of the corporations and act in their fiduciary capacities to the shareholders, and it's the responsibility of the Delaware judiciary to make sure that fiduciary obligation is upheld.
Can I ask you, as a matter of fact, whether there were more votes for these directors or more for withhold? I know they didn't get a majority, but how did the vote turn out?
I believe that it's either a for or a withhold. And there were more withholds.
There were more withholds than there were four. Does that make a difference?
Well, that's under the policy. That's what triggered the resignation. Well, they still had to get a majority. But yes,
could the shareholders have adopted a bylaw that would address this issue?
Yes, the shareholders could have adopted a bylaw to address this kind of issue. And as a matter of fact, the Delaware legislature's the amendments to the DGCL specifically contemplate something like that.
Is it significant that they did not?
No, and it's not significant that they did not, because the issue that we're talking about today is not how the mechanism by which the resignation was triggered, meaning if it's a bylaw or a policy or a certificate provision That's the mechanism that requires the resignation. What we're talking about here today is something different, and that's the decision on the other side of the directors, now that the resignation has been submitted, deciding what to do with that. And that decision and the factors that go into making that decision and the issues implicated by that decision are the exact same regardless of what prompted that, of the mechanism that prompted it.
Okay, but the bylaw could have required that the directors give an expansive, transparent, reason-based communique to shareholders explaining why they declined to accept the resignation.
Yes, the bylaw could, and as my opponent points out, other companies, in fact, do have bylaws that require that kind of expansive discussion.
Should we not respect the bylaw that the shareholders wanted?
No, because, first off, this isn't a bylaw, this is a policy. But the importance, let me back up. Directors don't get to decide for themselves what standard applies in reviewing their action. Delaware law decides that. By saying that the directors get to say that the business judgment rule applies because I wrote it this way, isn't the issue and isn't responsible. It puts the proverbial cart before the horse. The question is, they made this decision, what issues are implicated, what factors are implicated, and what does Delaware law have to say about that?
Well,
let's
take out of the equation, if we might, the element of the directors deciding for themselves what the standard ought to be by positing a bylaw initiated and adopted by shareholders,
okay,
which is worded exactly the same as the policy that's before us right now.
All right.
Would you argue that the court would have to disregard the director's judgment, even under those circumstances, not to accept resignation?
I'm not suggesting that the court ever has to reject the director's judgment at all.
But you are. If we defer, that is, respect the director's judgment, then there's no review, no consequence. What you're saying is that the court is required to disbelieve or to be skeptical enough about the director's explanation for their refusal to accept the resignations by allowing a shareholder books and records inspection under 220.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting liability, and I'm not suggesting you disregard the director's judgment.
But the question is there any consequence that ought to flow where the instrument, the document, whether you call it a bylaw or a policy, doesn't call for that?
Yes, and the reason is because, as I've suggested, the issues that are implicated in the deciding side of the V, when a director is called upon to make that decision, I have a resignation, am I going to accept it or not accept it? And by the way, the decision also has to be made by the resigning director that I've now resigned, am I going to still serve? But that the decision that is that the factors that go into making that decision and the issues that are implicated by that decision remain relevant. And the fact that a bylaw may say you have to have they have that discretion, they can make that discretion and says no more, doesn't change the fact that the shareholders still have the ability or should have the ability to ask why.
Okay, so you would be here even if we had before us a bylaw rather than a board adopted policy.
Yes, absolutely.
You only have a minute and 20 seconds for rebuttal. Do you want to save it?
I saved 10 minutes.
You've worked through it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will save it.
I didn't want you to end up with no time at all.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Court. This case has certainly garnered a lot of attention, both in the academic community and in other areas. It's garnered a lot of intellectual interest. And to their credit, I think Weston's lawyers have come up with almost every possible argument that they could. And because of that sort of throw everything but the kitchen sink approach to this case, if it's all right with the Court, what I would like to do is sort of address these things in order. sort of start with trying to put the case in perspective, then address the issue of whether the Court of Chancery actually applied the correct standard or not. And then three, finally get into the merits here and exactly do the analysis about whether or not, if you apply the 220 standard to the undisputed facts in this case, whether or not it creates an inference of wrongdoing sufficient to warrant an inspection under Section 220. Now, the reason I use the word perspective and want to start off with that is there is some what I would call sky is falling language in the briefs. Just by way of example, in the reply brief on page 20, they say, by rejecting plaintiff's 220 requests here, the Court of Chancery effectively removed the Delaware judiciary from the ability to form policy and develop law in the evolving area of director elections. Remove the judiciary? My understanding of the record below is the court didn't dismiss this case on subject matter or other jurisdictional grounds. The court was far from being removed. The Delaware judiciary is intimately involved in this case, as evidenced by this hearing today. The court below held a trial. The court below analyzed Delaware's law and policy, and ultimately determined that Delaware's law and policy did not warrant 220 inspection rights in this case.
Well, Mr. Reed, just as long as you're starting with the broader picture, in these unusual circumstances, why shouldn't the shareholders just get the books and records? Why isn't that a good policy? And then let's assume hypothetically it is. The question would be, should the court do it or should the General Assembly do it? But in these unusual circumstances where something is triggered where the directors have to resign and the board says we're not accepting your resignations, why shouldn't the shareholders get the information as a matter of course?
Well, you know, I might want to respectfully disagree with the issue about how unusual these circumstances are. Yes, it rarely occurs.
Let's assume they happen all the time. I'm willing to change it. I don't want you to get distracted from my real point is, if you have something in place that says if you don't get a majority of the votes, you have to resign, in those circumstances, even if it happens every day of the week, and the board says, well, no, we're not taking your resignation, under those circumstances, assuming they happen all the time, why shouldn't the shareholders get to know the reason as a matter of course?
Well, the reason I quibbled with the word unusual is because there are a lot of these policies out there. Yes, they've only been triggered three times, but there are a lot of policies out there. And if you can get records when they refuse to accept the rejections, why can't you get books and records when they do accept the resignations? You might argue that, look, I, as a shareholder, know what the articles and bylaws of this company say. These directors were validly elected under the articles and bylaws. I would like to investigate why they accepted these resignations instead of keeping these qualified directors on there.
All right. And I accept that amendment to my hypothetical.
Yes. Well,
so let's get to the question. Whether it's accepted or rejected, why isn't it a good policy to just get the information as a matter of course?
Well, because what you would see, I believe, if you're going to do things like require a company to produce board minutes and the other things that underline the board's decision in this regard, is you're going to see companies not have these policies. Because you're basically creating a per se rule that any single time they make a decision in this regard, and this is a decision like any other decision that they make. And this, under these circumstances, it would be a decision where 220 inspection rights would automatically be triggered. And I just think that's bad policy. I think that we ought to not change the standard here. We ought to adhere to the 220 standard, which is you can investigate for purposes of valuing your interest. They don't have that right here because it's a public company and the securities laws provide sufficient information on the valuation of the company. Or you have to get your rights under the other standard that's been around for years, and that is you have to create a reasonable inference of wrongdoing. Now, they suggest, and that's why I wanted to turn, if I've sufficiently answered your Honor's question, to turn to the issue of the standard in this case. They suggest that the Court of Chancery did not really apply the 220 standard. And I don't think they're being fair to the court, because if you look on page 10 of the opinion, under a heading titled Applicable Standard, the Court of Chancery quoted this court's decision in Seinfeld, where this court held that a 220 plaintiff must present, quote, some evidence to suggest a credible basis from which the court can infer that mismanagement, waste, or wrongdoing may have occurred. That is the standard that the court applied. And to prove it further, the court just didn't stop in setting it forth in the standard. The demand in this case focused on two things: the board's treatment of the SHI proposals and the board's rejection of the director resignations. Here's what the court said about the rejection of the director resignations on page 17 of the opinion. Quote, in short, the plaintiff has not demonstrated a logical, credible basis from which wrongdoing might be inferred from the board's retention of the three directors under the policy. As to the SHI proposals, on page 19 of the opinion, the court said that, quote, the plaintiff has not demonstrated any basis from which the court might infer wrongdoing in those decisions. They can argue with the court's conclusions, but they need to accept the fact, and they need to be fair to the Court of Chancery, that the Court of Chancery actually applied the right standard. Now, why did they lose in this case? And why didn't they get their inspection rights below? Well, it's pretty clear. It's because they made no effort whatsoever to explain to the Court of Chancery how the facts create an inference of probable wrongdoing or an inference that the directors may have breached their fiduciary duties. For example,
Where did the probable wrongdoing come from?
Your Honor, that comes from...
Because there seems to be a battle of words going on here. The word probable appears in your brief. The word may is underscored in Mr. Barry's brief. What are we talking about here?
I'll go with what this court said. Probable wrongdoing was used by this court in Security First versus U.S. Die Casting, 687 A. 2nd, 563 at page 565.
That was before the Thomas and Betts case, or
that was 1997.
And what did Seinfeld say when we went on bonk and we tried to sort this all out?
The language from Seinfeld is some evidence to suggest a credible basis from which the court can infer that mismanagement, waste, or wrongdoing may have occurred. I understand the difference in the language. I'm not sure it makes a difference in this particular case, because they made no effort below to argue why the facts would suggest that the board breached its duty of care by not conducting due diligence. They made no effort to argue how the facts here might suggest that these directors were somehow interested or lacked independence with regard to the decisions that they made. And they made no argument that somehow the facts created an inference of possible bad faith. What they did, and I think that the reason
Is there any reference to an entrenchment motive?
That's what they did, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record that would suggest it. They knew, presumably, they didn't make those arguments about the traditional ways you rebut the business judgment rule because the facts didn't exist. So what did they do? They came along and they argued that a different standard ought to apply to what the directors did here. They argued that UNICAL should apply to the board's dealings with the SHI proposals. And then they argued that UNICAL or Blasius ought to apply with regard to the rejection of the director resignations. Now, the court below did more than simply reject those propositions as a matter of law. The court rejected those as a matter of fact. The court said on pages 12 to 13 of the opinion, plaintiff fails to demonstrate any credible basis from which the court might infer the foundational assumptions upon which the plaintiff's theory rests, i.e. that the board's decision to retain the three directors was either motivated by entrenchment or was defensive in nature. The court continued, there is no support in the record of any entrenchment motive. Plaintiff has not shown why the court should suspect that the independent outside director members of the board were motivated to perpetuate the other three directors in office. Now, I think that finding ought to be entitled to considerable deference. That's precisely what this court said in Security First versus U.S. Die Casting when the court was hearing an appeal from a 220 case. The court said, quote, this court, the trial judge's determination of that credible basis after considering the totality of the evidence is entitled to considerable deference. But nonetheless, the Court of Chancery's ruling was consistent with this court's precedent. Let's deal first with the SHI proposals. The board's decision to say no to those proposals did not implicate UNICAL. This court made clear in Gantler versus Stevens that, quote, rejecting an acquisition offer without more is not defensive under UNICAL. Here, the Excels board wasn't confronted with a hostile takeover, and they did not adopt any defensive measures that would have gotten themselves in between the shareholders and a possible acquirer. They also try to...
Can I interrupt you for a moment, Mr. Reed? Going back to your last point, that the court found that there was no evidence of an infringement or disenfranchisement motive. The response to that by Mr. Berry is, well, there may not be any independent evidence of it, but there's a presumption that ought to apply, that there was a disenfranchisement motive, at least under the facts of this case, because Blasius, there was an arguable Blasius violation, that is, the will of the shareholders is being frustrated by the director's refusal to accept the resignation. So adding together the refusal and the Blasius, what they argue is the Blasius presumption, that equals an inference of wrongdoing.
Sure. And why don't I get to that? Because that was I was literally about a half a page away from that. It's sort of my last point, because I think it's clear the treatment of the SHI proposals didn't implicate Unocal. There's no Unocal argument here. But what they then go on and they try to apply Blasius to the decision here. And here's what they completely miss, I think. Hardis, Thompson, and Fletcher, the three directors, they were validly elected under Delaware law. If the stockholders wanted to vote them out, they could have run an alternative slate. They did not run an alternative slate. There is no allegation in this case.
Let me stop you there. Wouldn't that require a significant effort and a significant expense, whereas with a policy or a bylaw or whatever already in place that says, hey, enough withhold votes is and these directors have to submit their resignations, wouldn't the stockholders reasonably assume that having expressed their will in their with their vote, with their withhold vote, that the directors would not interfere with that expression of will. And then, you know, new directors would have to be found, but it wouldn't necessarily be the stockholders that have to go find them and put them up as a contesting slate.
Your Honor, I will concede that it is a much more difficult task to get your own slate up there and to get your own slate elected. But the will of these particular stockholders that issued their withhold votes has to be tempered by the company's governing documents. And let's look at what happened here. There is no allegation in this case that the governance policy was not followed. The three directors did precisely what they were supposed to do under the language. They resigned. The board did precisely what it was supposed to do. And
what
it made
was
a decision.
You mean what it was allowed to do?
Yes. Well, what it was supposed to do, Your Honor, with all due respect, was to make a decision. And they made that decision. What's the evidence of wrongdoing? I don't think there ought to be a presumption that any time they make this kind of decision one way or the other, that the 220 inspection rights are applied. I mean, you're talking about applying Blasius here, the most onerous standard we have in our corporate law. This court has said multiple times, in particular in Geyer and Liquid Audio, that it ought to be rarely applied, and only in situations where there is an intentional frustration of the shareholder franchise and a clear violation of Delaware law. What were the expectations of the stockholders in this case? Their expectations are that they could send a message to this board with their withhold votes, but their expectation also had to have been that these directors were being validly elected. Unless they decide to run an alternative slate, these directors were validly elected under Delaware law. And their expectation ought to have been that the board in this case was going to make a decision. And so, absent an entrenchment motive, absent a frustration of the policy, this particular decision ought to be treated like any other decision under Delaware law. They ought to defer to the board's business judgment. I'm not saying that in every case you couldn't get inspection rights. I think that maybe there are circumstances in which you could create an inference that there was some possible wrongdoing in a case.
So you're saying that if there's any room for the application of Blasius, it would only be in the way the election was conducted. Once you get beyond that point and it's established that there was a free and fair election, then Blasius should not be applied.
Yes, because they didn't do anything to frustrate the outcome. I mean, everything that was supposed to happen, both under the articles and bylaws and the governance policy of this company, happened. The directors resigned.
Go ahead.
And I wanted to come back to the Chief Justice's earlier question. How many votes were intentionally withheld versus how many were actually cast?
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't know the exact answer to that, and I don't know if I put it in the brief.
Well, we know they didn't get a majority in their favor.
That's right.
Do you have a recollection of whether there were more for or more withheld?
Oh, well, there were more withheld.
Okay.
Yes.
So from the director's point of view, if you're talking about frustrating the will of the shareholders, they're somewhat in a quandary because they have a certain group of shareholders that voted yes, and they have a certain number of shareholders that decided to withhold their vote. Should it make any difference what those percentages were when we're thinking about whether books and records should be produced?
I don't think it should make any difference. I think the question is, was there some wrongdoing by the board associated with its decision?
Well,
I mean, is there evidence for somehow that there was some gratuity provided to the remaining directors that would have encouraged them to, not accept the resignations? Well, is there some indication of wrongdoing? I apologize, Your Honor.
No. I hesitate to interrupt, but if I understand your position correctly, the wrongdoing would be under the rather stark circumstances that the corporate policy or a bylaw provided that once the three directors failed to get a majority of the votes, then they had to tender their resignation, and the policy would then say the board had to accept it. But the board, on the other hand, refused to accept it and seated them for the balance of the term. That would be clear wrongdoing because
Absolutely.
It would violate the policy. Does
Absolutely.
It have to be that kind of bright line? Is that your position?
I think you could write a policy many, many different ways. If you wrote a policy that said the resignations have to be accepted and the board didn't accept them, I think somebody ought to be able to investigate the reasons for that. If the policy required that the board publicly announce its decision and articulate, cover 10 different areas as to why these directors are qualified and they think they ought to continue, and for some reason the board didn't do that, I think that's an easy case. Because you would say they made a willful decision. At least you could draw an inference that they made a willful decision to violate the policy.
Did the board publish any form of communique to shareholders explaining why they
Yes.
refused to accept the resignation?
Yes, they did. It's in the record, Your Honor, A-324. And if I might, as long as I can read
it. One of the reasons that one or more of the directors served on the audit committee
Yes.
and had special qualifications
Yes.
or on a risk management committee, on some other special committee?
Those are precisely some of the explanations. They said, first of all, these three directors were experienced and knowledgeable, that if they were off the board, it would leave the board with only four directors instead of the seven, that the board continued, the company wanted to continue to focus on trying to negotiate with something with SHI, and having to get new directors in the interim was going to cause delay in that regard. One of them was the lead director, and each one of them independently served on three different committees. These are the reasons that they articulated. In my view, that's a business judgment.
Let's assume hypothetically that, as a matter of fact, there is an entrenchment motive that would be revealed by some document. We're all going to stand together. We've got to resist this SHI proposal because we'll all be out of work, da-da-da-da-da, down the line. Are the facts that have been alleged, are they not consistent with an entrenchment motive? They may not conclusively prove it, but are they consistent with an entrenchment motive, where rejecting the SHI proposal, selling the central asset later on for the price that it was sold, can an inference be drawn from that there was an entrenchment?
No, and I would say that for this reason. First of all, they wanted to explore the sale to SHI. It was an issue of negotiating the confidentiality agreement. But more importantly, this was a staggered board. These directors, if they didn't accept or if they accepted these resignations, they were going to fill these seats. That's why I say Unical, no different standard ought to apply here. Unical shouldn't apply here because there was no challenge to corporate control. These directors were going to decide, the remaining directors were going to decide who had these slots.
So you're saying that they could have accepted these resignations and then turned around and reelected these same people and that'd be no problem?
It's a theory.
Yeah, those are
matter.
Different facts, but I think the answer to that's probably yes.
And just in doctrinal terms, you're arguing that while as a theoretical matter it may be possible to infer, to draw an inference of wrongdoing, it's not a credible inference in these circumstances.
Yeah, I guess what I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is that I could envision circumstances, facts out there that someone could argue creates the inference. But this is not, the law is clear, a credible inference of probable wrongdoing or a credible inference that wrongdoing may have occurred. I don't understand how this court could say to these independent directors, who all they did was make a decision, somehow are held possibly engaged in wrongdoing without some fact. There isn't one single fact. I mean, from the day this case started, I kept asking for someone to come forward with a fact so that I can respond to it. What's the fact that suggests wrongdoing?
What Mr. Berry says in his brief is if you go back to Unocal, Unocal is premised on the omnipresent specter that you may want to retain your board seat. A whole doctrine developed based on that omnipresent specter.
The board these directors didn't make the decision to retain their board seat. It was made by other independent directors, Your Honor, in compliance with the policy. See, what I think they have here is they have...
In other words, the directors that made the decision to refuse the resignation weren't threatened at all.
That's right. They were sitting there completely independent, weren't interested in this at all. There's no reason under our law to impose a different standard. And let's assume this court goes through the analysis that I've gone through and says Unocal doesn't apply here. Certainly Blasius doesn't apply here. Nobody interfered with the shareholder franchise. What are we left with? What we're left with is a group of stockholders who disagree with the judgments of the Excellus board. Now look, I can understand why they might want to do that. You know, $6 a share.
It's a pretty important group.
It is, Your Honor. But $6 a share, you know, looking with hindsight, a year later, when the whole world has suffered more than an economic hiccup, you'd say to yourself, boy, I wish I had that opportunity again. It was probably a very bad business judgment not to have done it at the time. It's not any indication of wrongdoing. You know, if you are disappointed with the board's decision-making process, if you're unhappy with what they did with regard to these three directors, you do have alternatives. You can run an alternative slate. That's what our law enables stockholders to do anytime they disagree with the business judgment, unless they can rebut the business judgment rule.
Well,
and you can't do that.
I want to come back to this omnipresent specter because I don't think I asked my question very well. To the extent the board were kindred spirits and the four incumbents who reelected the people who had to tender the resignation kept a group of kindred spirits together, you'd be wondering whether the four decided to keep their three colleagues because there was a unity of interest in resisting anybody. And that's what I'm talking about as the omnipresent specter that the four might have been thinking about.
I don't think that's the type of credible evidence that any of the members of our Delaware judiciary have heard these cases going back years now thinks would apply. I don't think that those circumstances, I mean, that is just simply saying the mere circumstance that these directors decided to retain these other directors creates an inference of wrongdoing. I think this court ought to hold the plaintiff to the standard we've always applied. Come forward with evidence. Like I said before, if there was some evidence that they were
let me interrupt you there. We're not talking about a substantive lawsuit, if you want to call it that. We're talking about a 220 request. And this court has also said that the way you're supposed to find out the evidence is by using the tools at hand and seeking books and records and other appropriate information through 220. So aren't you really putting the stockholder in a position where it's going to be virtually impossible to satisfy the kind of standard you're talking about when that's not what we should be looking at for 220 purposes?
But Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't think our court has ever said that your mere ownership of stock and your mere disagreement with the board's judgment gives you 220 inspection rights. You still have a standard that you must satisfy.
But didn't we say in Seinfeld you don't need to present evidence? We specifically said you don't need to present evidence.
You don't have to. I agree. You have to present a record that creates a credible inference of wrongdoing. And I don't know what the facts in this record are that create the credible inference of wrongdoing. That's what I'm struggling with. You don't get 220 inspection rights when you disagree with the board's judgment. What you get is you throw them out and get directors in there whose judgment you think you will agree with. Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't know if I was up or not. It stopped at 3 seconds on me.
Yeah, well, you were in the
red. I apologize.
Next argument, you owe us 3 minutes.
Your Honors, very quickly. First off, we've discussed the Blasius and the uniqueness of the argument. So for him, for my colleague to stand up and say this is just like any other decision is simply wrong. We're not asking about the kind of inspection rights to happen, whether or not they accept the offer, whether or not they accept the resignations. When you decline to accept the resignation, that's the unique issue. Second, with regard to the standard, you're right. The facts that we've laid out here are consistent with acting in perhaps in an entrenchment motive. The argument that we didn't satisfy the credible basis standard because I didn't present evidence of entrenchment of an of a primary purpose to frustrate the vote or an evidence of entrenchment, the subject of motivation, that's precisely the kind of information that I need to exercise my 220 request for. The fact that based on the facts, the inference can be created that they were acting defensively, and not only in the rejection of the resignations itself can be characterized as defensive, I need to keep these people on in order to move forward with something that I wasn't interested in moving forward on, which is exactly what we've alleged.
Your UNICAL argument would be stronger, would it not, if a majority of the board's fitness for office was being challenged in the way that occurred here?
No, because UNICAL doesn't depend on whether or not the existence of UNICAL and the existence of the duties doesn't depend on whether or not there's a staggered board.
Well, assume that you had a board of 10 and only one director was up.
Yes.
Counterfactually.
Sure.
And the same thing happened here. There were the withhold votes were greater than the four votes.
Yes.
You're telling me that we should apply a UNICAL omnipresent specter presumption?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor. I am saying that, for example, if there was an entrenchment motive and they, in fact, breached their fiduciary duties because of a blatant entrenchment motive because of that, then they still breached their fiduciary duties. What I am suggesting is that where you have the existence of the classified board, the existence of the one director out of 10, may impact the scope and seriousness of the threat, which may be relevant to the evaluating the reasonableness of the response. But it doesn't eliminate the fiduciary duties altogether.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the case under advisement to recess.